Howard Oakes, Vice President for the Health Sciences. In my office on December 23rd.
Yeah, great. Yes, I saw
him at his home. Why did you suggest him?
Because he, I think, as a trustee, still one of the trustees involved for the longest period of time. And I never had a particular involvement in the creation of the construction fund.
Yes. Okay. Let's go ahead with the questions down to a certain point, and then you can fly as you like after that.
Right.
I want to get... There's a certain structure.
I need to leave about 20 minutes after 2. I have a watch, so I'll have to count on you.
I do. It's 1. But that should be enough time, I think. Just watch this little light.
A little red one?
A little red light.
All right.
And when it goes off, let me know.
Stop.
Yeah. All right, question number 1. Name, department, rank, or position.
I'm Howard Oakes, Vice President for Health Sciences, Professor of Dental Medicine.
2, what year did you come to Stony Brook?
I came July 1, 1968.
68. And how old were you at the time?
38.
38. From what institution and position did you come?
I came from Harvard, where I was acting dean of the dental school.
I see. And your position here was what?
I came here to be dean of the dental school.
Dental school, right. Who was primarily responsible for your coming to Stony Brook?
Edmund Pellegrino, who had invited me to come as a consultant in 1967 and subsequently offered me the position of dean in the spring of 1968.
Okay. Who interviewed you for the position here? I suppose he did.
Ed Pellegrino did, John Tull did, and Al Newton, who was the other professional involved in the development of the health center at that time.
Right. Incidentally, do you know where he is now?
I'm sorry. Also, I talked to Bentley Glass when I came here the first time. Al Newton, I believe, is professor of genetics at the University of Pennsylvania. If not, he's professor of genetics at the University of Texas Medical Center at Houston.
I see. Why did you come? What factors were important in your decision?
I believe that Stony Brook was on its way to being among the best of the public institutions in the United States. I had read and been favorably impressed with the pieces that appeared about Stony Brook in Science. I knew a good deal about the plans for the development of the Health Sciences Center and its relation to the General University campus. I found all of those to be attractive and consistent with my own goals in education. I also had decided that time had come for me to leave Harvard, and that there were no circumstances under which I was going to stay, so I was willing to consider... I was interested in the possibility of leaving. I had spent all of my previous life in a private institution. I believed that the future of health professions education, and certainly dental education, was much rosier in the public than in the private sector, and so I was interested in coming to a public institution. I was also interested in coming to a new one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Covered this somewhat. What was your...
I should stop.
What?
There were several ideas about the development of the Health Sciences Center and its relation to the rest of the university that were very attractive to me. The highly integrated nature of the center, the expectation that it would have uniquely close academic relations with other disciplines outside of health sciences were things that I had been interested in before. I never heard of Stony Brook, but which I saw as strong parts of the program goals here. I was also impressed with the state commitment to develop not only Stony Brook, but a first-rate system of public higher education. Personal factors, as there always are in those decisions. It had nothing to do with the nature and the character of the university itself. I had been commuting a long distance into Boston, and with a wife and five children, as I looked at the positions that were being offered to me, this was not the first dental school deanship that I had considered. I was interested in going to a university where I would like to live. That ruled out, from my personal point of view at that stage of my life, an urban institution or a great deal of commuting. I said to my wife, when she expressed astonishment and dismay that anyone would essentially make a lateral transfer from Harvard to any other institution, since I'd been offered the position as dean at Harvard the day before I was offered the position here, I told her that one of my interests was in working in a new university that I'd be pleased to have my children go to. I saw the opportunity to contribute to Stony Brook as the opportunity to help build the university of first quality. Right. Those were important things to me. Yeah.
What were your impressions of Stony Brook when you first came? The campus, the people, the leadership spirit?
First, the people. The individual with whom I had the greatest amount of interaction, both as a consultant in 1967 and later when I was offered the position in 1986, was Ed Palladino. Like many others, I was much taken with his dynamism, with his ideas about health professions, education, his concern and support for disciplines other than his own, namely other than medicine, and with his personal qualities. I saw him as a person that would be easy and exciting to work with. I knew a lot about Ed Palladino because one of my close friends was the dean of the dental school of Kentucky when Ed went there as professor of medicine, and at the time when I was considering the position here, he had become the vice president for administration of the university. So I'd heard about Ed from people whose opinions I held in the highest regard. The other person with whom I had some interaction, but very much less, was with John Toll. My interaction with other individuals at the campus was not of any great consequence in my own decision. I found John to be also exciting, dynamic, committed to the same objectives that I was committed to, and sympathetic to the interests that I realized I would represent, namely to building a first-rate dental school in a new academic health center in a new university. And my interaction with those two individuals was a strong positive factor. Had my interaction with particularly at Palladino, probably to a lesser degree John Toll, had been the reverse, I would have not come here in spite of the institutional potential that I saw here. I had been in full-time dental school administration for 8 years. I have had a fair number of close relatives who've been university presidents and the like, and I understood the importance, especially in a new institution, of cordial personal interactions. What do I think about Stony Brook as a place? Well, John Toll asked me within the first 3 or 4 minutes, what impressions I had of Stony Brook. He realized I'd been here several times as a consultant, a legitimate consultant, helping in facilities and in academic planning, and so he recognized that I had seen more of the campus and knew more about the place than might be the situation with someone who was making their first visit having been offered a position. I told John that I asked him if he really wanted an honest answer. He said he did. And he said, no, he didn't want an honest answer. If I thought he hadn't, I would have had reservations. I told him that the day before I'd been at the University of California at Santa Cruz, And did he really want a comparison of Stony Brook with Santa Cruz? A comparison that, aside from the absence of a health sciences center, had the legitimacy of two new institutions in vigorous public universities committed to very high quality. Of course, I drew a comparison that in some measures, some ways, was unfavorable. At that stage, the Santa Cruz campus had probably fewer students than Stony Brook did. It had taken what I thought was spectacular advantage of a handsome site, and I was dismayed to see how the university had developed what I could recognize by looking at the woods to be perhaps not quite as spectacular, but certainly a first-rate university site in every respect. One of the things that I was impressed with was that most of the people who held senior administrative positions at the university had very little administrative experience. They may have been first-rate intellects and first-rate scholars, but by the standards by which I would have judged competency of university administrators, they were almost completely inexperienced. John Tall had been here for perhaps 3 years, and aside from being a department chairman, had had no comparable experience. Same thing was true of Ed Pellegrino. And I thought that unusual. I recognized it contributed to open minds, but I also was concerned about whether the people who were managing the institution knew a lot about managing.
Give me a second.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Yes. That's a new name to me.
I believe he chaired the portion of the Muir Commission report that focused on dentistry and wrote the chapter on dentistry. I knew him quite well. He subsequently, I misspoke. At the time when the Muir Commission report was written, Joe Volker was probably either the dean of the dental school at the University of Alabama or the vice president for health sciences at a time when only the health units existed in Birmingham. He subsequently became the president of the University of Alabama at Birmingham when the health units became the nucleus of a general university campus very much like ours. And later he served as the first chancellor for the higher education system in Alabama when it was organized. But Joe Volker was a dentist, heavily involved in the Muir Commission initial studies. I knew about the studies from him. He was a member of the Harvard Visiting Committee to the medical school and the dental school, and of course as one of the eminent people in dental education, Joe that is, I knew him quite well, independent of anything to do with the Muir Commission study. But he had talked to me about the place, and there were others of us in dentistry who were interested in what was going on at Stony Brook, had high hopes for the school. So after the report was published, I got a copy of it, and I read it, and I read, of course, the chapter about development of the Health Sciences Center at Stony Brook, and was pleased 2 years later, 4 years later, 1967, when I was asked to come here along with Joe Volker and Al Morris, then the dean of the dental school at Kentucky, to provide consultant services about the program and the facilities.
Okay.
I've referred back to the Muir Commission report many times, most recently in the introductory paragraph of a memorandum to Jack Marburger, in which I sketched out the process we will now use in 1987 for creating a new master plan for the Health Sciences Center, essentially to be completed next year, 25 years after the Muir Commission report. We've written the first sentence, essentially introduces our current master planning process by reference to that document. The document spelled out what the Health Sciences Center should be like. The number of programs, their size, the presence of a university-owned hospital on the campus, and the development of the Health Sciences Center to this date has largely been the implementation of the Muir Commission report. It's splendid for everyone at the university to take credit for what happened and for the ideas and the relation to the rest of the university and the nature of the programs, but if you look at the Health Sciences Center with your today, holding the Muir Commission report as your focusing device, the Health Sciences Center today is what the Muir Commission report said it should be. Right. One of those astonishing events that so rarely occur when somebody developed a rational plan and then implemented it.
Yeah, right. Muir and Lester Evans came into my office in, I think, the fall of 62. I haven't been here more than about 2 months. Unannounced. And around and told me what they had in mind, and I got quickly our graduate council together and talked something like that. And then the report came out in 63.
Okay. What events, what persons, what experiences stand out in your mind?
Well, in a sense, I've been here since the creation of the Health Sciences Center, and so the literal answer to that is thousands of people and events. I consider myself very fortunate to have been along for this exciting, in my case, 19-year ride. An enormous amount has been accomplished here. And every bit of it has been personally rewarding and stimulating to me and very exciting. I frequently, during the entire period, consciously said to myself how fortunate I was to have landed here at that time and been swept along by these events. Shortly after I came, Sam Gould invited Ed Pellegrino and the rest of us to have dinner with him at the University Club. This was probably 1970. maybe 1969. And we were all worried about getting the resources to start the educational programs on the schedule that had been laid out in the SUNY master plan of 1965, I guess, probably. I can remember Sam Gould saying, there's an inevitability to Stony Brook, and I think he was right. It's been very exciting. The details, the specific responses would be so numerous that I'd have to sit and organize it, and you'd have to tell me how many words I was limited to, and if it was as few as 5,000, it would take me a long time to get it down. When I became Health Sciences Vice President, or when Ed left and I became the Acting Vice President in 1973, in the fall of 1973, I inherited his budget proposal from the summer of 1973, which included a base budget for the Health Sciences Center of a little bit less than $4 million. I forgot what the request was for the next year, but the Health Sciences Center budget now is about almost $250 million. A lot of exciting things happen when you go from $4 million to $240 million, which is what the health sciences budget probably will be by the end of this year.
I'll ask some questions about that. So you've answered 10, I guess. What was your understanding of your own place in the future of Stony Brook? Why do you think you were appointed? I think
Well, I saw my role when I came here as primarily the development of a new dental school and a new academic health center. That was an exciting opportunity. I understood, I think, fairly clearly what that entailed. I'd been in dental education full-time for 12 years. I'd been in a senior administrative position where I worked before for 8 of those years. I was on the National Institutes of Health Committee that was giving away all the money to build new academic health centers. I'd been probably to every dental school and every academic health center in the United States and paid a particularly attention to the good dental schools and the new institutions. While I felt very wet behind the ears at age 38 coming to a position that I thought one only ought to come to after about 25 years of that kind of experience, I thought then, and in retrospect I still believe that I understood what I was supposed to do to create a first-rate dental school. Also believed and think that the university expected me to play a modest role in the development of the university as a whole. Was there anything unique about my background or experiences or interests or talents that qualified me for that? But I sensed, but I sensed that the state of development of the institution, its newness, its openness, and the fact that people were coming from all over the world to create this new institution meant that there was a particular obligation on everybody, but certainly on the senior academic administrators, to contribute as widely as they possibly could. I realized as I worked with people here, and as I said, many of whom were extremely talented people but had not had a decade or a lifetime of experience in university administration, that the university needed a lot of that, and so there were opportunities for me to put in my 2 cents worth and help in planning things that weren't directly related to the dental school that I felt were important to the university and that drew on either interests or personal experiences that I'd had before I came here. That was part of the excitement of being here.
Were your activities confined to the Stony Brook campus, or did you have relations outside with Albany or elsewhere?
They were certainly not confined to the Stony Brook campus. During the period that I've been here, and particularly during the earlier parts of it, I spent a great deal of time in Albany and a great deal of time in Washington. I was reminded of that, I think, in 1972, when I was sitting on an airplane and the stewardesses asked us to fill in a customer survey. survey designed to find out how satisfied we were with their service. So the first question was, how many individual airline flights have you taken during the past 12 months? It was right before Christmas. And I tend to, I like to answer questionnaires, and I tend to do so in a rather literal fashion. The definition of a flight would have meant was any ground-to-ground trip. So if you were flying to California and stopping in Chicago and changing airplanes, as I recall, that would have constituted two flights, not one. I took out my appointment book, and as best I could, I reconstructed the number of flights I had taken in a literal fashion. It was around 270, as best I could estimate it. That was a reflection of the degree to which travel, primarily to Albany and Washington, but also to Chicago, where the architects were, and on behalf of the federal government all over the United States. So I spent a lot of time away from the campus, most of it working on things relating to the Health Sciences Center or more specifically to the dental school, but I did a lot of professional travel related to my own professional career and to my position on the NIH committee that gave away all the health professions construction money.
Okay.
I had in Albany, I was fortunate to have interactions with practically everybody that figured significantly in the Health Sciences Center, except for the governor, after I got here. Never had any direct dealings with Governor Rockefeller or with Norman Herd, who was then the director of state operations, but at one time or another had very direct workings with other directors of state operations, with the budget directors.
Who were they? Remember? Axelrod?
Yes. With Axelrod, when he was the director of the education unit, with Red Miller, when he was the director of the budget during the 1970s.
Red Miller.
Yes. Red Miller was the director of budget during the 1970s.
Okay. Villette?
Paul Villette. Right. Subsequently with Alex Rollo, and who's now the head of the education unit, with all their staffs, from time to time with the heads of other major budget division, parts of the division of the budget, with the mental health and mental retardation and the health units. So because of the scope of activities of the Health Sciences Center, we've had regular interaction with parts of the division of the budget that the rest of the university would not interact with at all, and for that matter with parts of state government, with the heads of OGS and a number of other agencies. Extensive interactions with the Office of Mental Hygiene, Office of Mental Retardation, Developmental Disabilities, and with the Health Department. Good bit, of course, with the Construction Fund as well. Some with Tony Adinolfi before he died, and subsequently a good deal with Oscar Lanford, and most recently with Irv Friedman. First worked with Irv and with Hank DeLay when they were legislative aides to the education committees in the assembly. That goes back to the 60s. Continued to have interaction with Hank in all the capacities in which he served. And, of course, we interacted.
Where is he now?
He's now Director of State Operations, a position Norman Herd had to Rockefeller.
I see.
And, of course, I've had frequent interactions with everybody in the central administration and with many of the trustees, particularly closely with Jim Warren, with Beth Moore, with Don Blinken, with Judy Moyers.
All right. At some point, I don't know whether this is the point or not, I want to ask you how much support you have received and how much understanding you felt you had from the central office and the governor's office.
I have personally felt that the understanding and the support from everyone in the city of Albany, with perhaps just a few exceptions from time to time, has been exemplary. I have felt that when Rockefeller was governor, when Kerry was governor, they personally understood and were interested in what was going on in the Health Sciences Center. When Hugh Carey would come to Long Island on business and his wife would come with him, they would come to visit us. And his wife told me on one occasion that she particularly liked to come to the Health Sciences Center and tried to do that whenever the governor was on Long Island, and that he himself encouraged her to come. Well, I saw that as a reflection of the understanding and the commitment to the Health Sciences Center by the governor's office. Certainly, we had tremendous support from individuals who've been in the position of director of state operations. I think we have also had very good support in the Health Sciences Center from the Division of the Budget, from everyone in the legislature who was in any way involved with higher education or with health, and that support in the legislative and executive branch is still very strong, and it's of the utmost importance, both in terms of the morale of the center and their operational requirements. Some of the individuals who occupied positions of importance to us, I think, are probably unique in the, or have been unique in the American scene, in their understanding of health sciences and their interest and support for the center. From a system which regularly grouses about the support that it gets from its own central administration, from the Division of Budget, from the legislature, and from the government, you won't hear that from me. To be sure, the bureaucracy is difficult, glacial, but while that fact has delayed things, required justification, that sometimes it seemed to be endless and even unproductive, first, last, and always, there's been tremendous support for the Health Sciences Center from everybody in the city of Albany.
All right, now, who else should I interview to get that point of view from the other side, from those?
I would interview Hank DeLay.
Hank DeLay, all right.
Currently Director of State Operations, but Hank's had been Vice Chancellor in the university system on two occasions, and he's been the Governor's Secretary for Education and the Arts, and he's held key positions as a legislative aide early in his career. Governor Kerry himself played important roles in the decision to move ahead with the dental school when its future was somewhat troubled. Kevin Cahill, who was his secretary for health as well as his family physician, not a government professional, was significantly involved.
Where is he?
You'd find him practicing medicine on Fifth Avenue.
Kevin Cahill?
Yeah. Went dead, you'd certainly want to talk to Red Miller. It was Red Miller who made the decision about the size of the university hospital, a decision that was crucial to the hospital being built at a time when there was serious reservation about the hospital. And you would have certainly wanted to talk to Jim Kelly. But unfortunately, those two individuals are both dead. Jim was the executive vice chancellor of the university when Ernie Boyer was the chancellor and became the acting chancellor after Ernie left, served in that position until Cliff Wharton became the chancellor.
I see. But and Jim Kelly is dead. And you say, is Red Miller dead?
Yes.
I see.
He was director of the budget, I think, generally when the governor was a Democrat, and probably the first deputy when the governor was a Republican. He'd been a professor of business at Maxwell. And it was said for many years that Jim Kelly, that Red Miller was the only person who could put together the New York State budget. A gruff, no-nonsense guy who I think a lot of people felt gave the university perpetual fits and conniptions. But when an important decision had to be made, and it was Red Miller's to make, he made the decisions, and it seems to me in the several instances where his were pivotal to the development of the physical facilities that he was well informed, and for all his gruff and bureaucratic and political appearances, was a smart, savvy, sensitive person who supported the center. too bad that some of those people are gone and their observations about Stony Brook gone with them, because there are half a dozen or so people who played an essential role from the position they held in Albany in the development of the center.
All right, now let me see. Kelly, Red Miller.
Ernie Boyer? Can I talk to Ernie Boyer? You certainly want to talk to Ernie Boyer.
Yes, I will. Now, he is in either Princeton or Philadelphia now.
I'm not quite sure where.
Kind of. Kind of.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. What was his role?
Ernie was the executive vice chancellor when Gould was chancellor.
I see.
After Gould resigned, Ernie was appointed to, I think, probably to the position of acting chancellor, and shortly thereafter as chancellor, and he served in that position until he went to be commissioner of education in the office, in the Federal Office of Education. So he was the chancellor, and here I'm going to guess the years, probably from 1972 through 1977. Ernie was supportive of the development of Stony Brook and of the Health Sciences Center. He had the misfortune to be the chancellor during the New York City financial crisis, which became a state financial crisis, which became a Stony Brook financial crisis. We always used to say at that stage that the state university is a tenth of the state budget and Stony Brook is a tenth of the university budget. So when the state got, to borrow that old hackneyed phrase, when the state got cold, Stony Brook got pneumonia. And Ernie was the chancellor during the city and the state financial crisis. One of the smartest things he did, one of the smartest things he could have done, he did. Shortly after he was appointed chancellor, he recruited a man by the name of James Kelly to be the executive vice chancellor. That was a position he had held himself before he became chancellor. Jim Kelly had been the controller of the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare when the Democrats held the White House. So he'd been the controller of HEW under Kennedy and under Johnson. He was the controller of HEW when Medicare and Medicaid were legislated and administered. On retirement from federal service, became the executive vice chancellor for Georgetown University and was directly involved in their academic health center, which included a big hospital and a medical school and dental school and some other programs. And Ernie recruited Jim to come to the system as executive vice chancellor. It appeared to me that the way Ernie operated the university during the period of time when he was chancellor was he was primarily the outside man, and Jim Kelly was, for at least not academic purposes, the inside man. There were a series of chief academic officers during that period of time, which was after Harry Porter left the system. By that time, the development of the Health Sciences Center was primarily not an academic development, which is to say all the academic things were in place. It was primarily a fiscal and a physical development. We were in the midst of spending enormous amounts of money to build this spectacular complex and to get ready to open our hospital. While Jim Kelly was not a health professional by background, he's a lawyer by background, a public administrator, his own professional career in the federal government, subsequently at Georgetown, meant that he knew a lot about health education, health sciences, health professions. At the time that he came, he was the director of the national study being conducted by the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy to determine the cost of health manpower education and subsequently to determine the cost of residency education. So Jim was immersed up to the top of his head in the warp and woof of the financing and delivery of health care. From our point of view, there couldn't have been a better person for Ernie to have appointed.
Yeah, understanding.
He was sitting right on top of all the things on behalf of the university that were of primary concern to us. I had known Jim before he came to SUNY, and he was a tough, smart, savvy person, but an excellent person to work with or for. And he did a tremendous amount for the Health Sciences Center during the period of time when its physical facilities and its budget were growing just by leaps and bounds.
Yeah.
he subsequently retired after Cliff was appointed and then died a year later.
I see. All right.
That's a long answer to your question. Did I have any involvement with people in Albany?
Yeah.
Yes,
right.
A great deal, and they were very supportive of the center.
Right. I wish we could say that for some of the other phases of the university.
I wish that more people at Stony Brook and in the university felt that they could say it in general about the support for the whole system, the whole campus, as well as the Health Sciences Center. Perhaps my perspective or my personality or my interaction with people in Albany was different than others, but I felt very strongly that, with some notable exceptions, we had very strong support, and that support was essential to the Health Sciences Center becoming what it was. Mm-hmm. Interesting to compare the Health Sciences Center at Stony Brook with the other new medical schools or academic health centers that were cast upon the American scene during the same period of time. By that period of time, I mean in the last 30 years.
Right. Which ones, for instance?
Well, a number of new medical schools started in the 1960s and in the 1970s.
Any on the East Coast?
Well, probably 20. If you go back to the late 1950s, what started? The University of Connecticut, the University of Massachusetts, Albert Einstein, Mount Sinai, New Jersey College of Medicine and Dentistry.
Right,
Urban. Today, those that are north of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And similar developments went on everywhere else in the United States. If you can look at what the Health Sciences Center at Stony Brook has become since that period began, you could arguably say that Stony Brook is the best and most diverse, most strongly supported, and highest quality of any of those new institutions. It has quickly, by everybody's standards, in medicine, in dentistry, in allied health, in nursing, in social welfare, from the point of view of the hospital, from the point of view of education, research, or patient care, shouldered its way into the first rank of American academic health centers. There's only one other new institution that could lay claim to that, and that is a much simpler institution, the University of California Medical School at San Diego, which is a first-rate medical school. But I don't think there's anybody that would argue with the fact that those are the two institutions that went from a dream to being first-rate institutions in that roughly that 30-year period of time dating back to the late 50s. They date back to the late 50s because it was at about that time that there was the first articulation of what was perceived as the national need for a major expansion in health professions education and health and in the provision of health care. The national commitment to research, the creation of the National Institutes of Health, and the beginning of a big growth in the funding of research went back a few years before that. But it was the period right before and after 1960 in which those national goals were articulated and medical education and other health professions education expanded so tremendously.
Okay. Now, I've got some special questions here. Let me run through them before we...
It's still okay. No, it's still red. I just couldn't quite see it.
Yeah. I want to check these out. I'm thinking of the early planning and construction, that is, and building, that is, both construction and staffing of the Health Sciences Center. Who else should I talk to about that? Now, I know that Elliot has left.
I would suggest that you talk to each of the deans who were first recruited. I'm one of them. Ed McTernan, the Dean of Allied Health, is the second, and he's the senior dean. would want to talk to Marvin Kushner, because Marvin became the dean of the medical school before Ed Pellegrino left and was the dean up until this summer. Ellen Fahey, who came here to be the dean of the School of Nursing, I think Ellen came in 1969.
How do you spell her name?
F-A-H-Y. She's now the dean of nursing at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. Sandy Kravitz, who came to be the first dean of the School of Social Welfare, he's now a professor at Florida Atlantic University in Miami.
All right, let me get that. I'm going to get that up. His last name again?
Kravitz. K-R-A-V-I-T-Z.
K-I-T-Z. First name?
Sanford.
Sanford. And Florida Atlantic. That's
in Miami.
In Miami.
I think so, yes. And if you want...
Not Boca Raton.
Oh, I think it's got several divisions. I believe he's in the Miami division. And if you needed any of their phone numbers, if you just gave me a call, we could give them to you, because we probably have one of our Rolodex.
Okay.
Peter Rogatz, who was the first director of the hospital.
Yes. Is he still at North Shore Bridge?
No. He is... I'm not exactly sure what his current professional position is, but he's still active professionally. He has been primarily as a consultant.
Right.
And again, we can give you his phone number.
Okay.
You want to talk to Michael Elliott, because he became the hospital director during the final stages of construction and the opening of the hospital.
That's two L's and two T's?
Yes. I believe he's executive director, maybe at Lenox Hill. At one of the hospitals in New York City now. Again, we could find him for you if you needed some assistance.
I would, yes.
So that's the... Want to talk to Arthur Upton? He became the dean of the School of Basic Science. Arthur's now a professor of environmental medicine at NYU.
Environmental medicine.
Okay.